to someone. It might as well be the most forbidding-looking person she could find. We were very young then, you know. Once we'd finally got ourselves registered, she and I went for a coffee together, and then we arranged to meet again the next day. Well, when I say arranged, Abby told me. I'm going on the library tour tomorrow at noon, see you there. And walked off before I could answer, either way. By that time, I already knew that I admired her. It was a novel sensation for me. I don't admire many people. But she was so determined, so vivid. She made everyone I had met before seem pale and shadowy by comparison. You've probably noticed. Daniel smiled faintly, glancing up at me over his glasses. That I have a tendency to keep myself at some distance from life. I had always felt that I was an observer, never a participant. That I was watching from behind a thick glass wall as people went about the business of living, and did it with such ease, with a skill that they took for granted and that I had never known. Then Abby reached straight through the glass and caught my hand. It was like an electric shock. I remember watching her walk off across Front Square. She was wearing this awful fringed skirt that was much too long for her. She looked drowned in it, and realizing that I was smiling. Justin was on the library tour the next day. He hung back a step or two behind the group, and I wouldn't even have noticed him if it hadn't been for the fact that he had a hideous cold. Every 60 seconds or so he came out with this enormous, explosive wet sneeze, and everyone would jump and then snicker, and he would turn an extraordinary shade of beetroot and try to disappear into his handkerchief. He was obviously excruciatingly shy. At the end of the tour, Abby turned around to him, as if we'd known one another all our lives, and said, "We're going for lunch. Are you coming?" I've seldom seen anyone look so startled. His mouth popped open, and he mumbled something that could have meant anything. But he went over to the buttery with us. By the end of lunch, he was actually speaking in full sentences, and interesting ones, too. We'd read a lot of the same things. He had some insights into John Donne that had never occurred to me. It hit me that afternoon that I liked him, that I liked both of them. That for the first time in my life, I was enjoying the company of others. You don't strike me as the kind of person who's ever had difficulty making friends. I'm not sure you can understand quite what a revelation that was. It took us until classes started the next week to find Rafe. The three of us were sitting at the back of a lecture room waiting for the lecturer to show up, when all of a sudden the door beside us flew open and there was Rafe. Dripping with rain, hair plastered to his head, fists clenched, obviously straight out of some traffic mess and in a horrible mood. It was a pretty dramatic entrance. Abby said, "Check it out, it's King Lear." And Rafe whipped around on her and snarled, "You know how he gets." "How did you get here, then? In Daddy's limo? Or on your broomstick?" Justin and I were taken aback, but Abby just laughed and said, "By hot air balloon," and pushed a chair towards him. And after a moment he sat down and muttered, "Sorry." And that was that. Daniel smiled, down at the leaf, a private little smile as tender and amazed as a lover's. How did we ever put up with one another? Abby talking 19 to the dozen to hide her shyness, Justin half smothered under his, Rafe biting people's heads off right and left, and me. I was terribly serious, I know. It wasn't until that year, really, that I learned how to laugh. "And Lexi?" I asked, very softly. "How did you find her?" "Lexi," Daniel said. The smile rippled across his face like wind on water, deepened. "Do you know, I can't even remember the first time we met her. Abby probably can. You should ask her. All I remember is that by the time we had been post-grads for a few weeks, she seemed to have been there forever. He put the leaf down gently on the bench beside him and wiped his fingers on his handkerchief. "It always took my breath away," he said, "that the five of us could have found one another, against such odds through all the layers of armored fortifications each of us had set up. A lot of it was Abby, of course. I've never known what instinct led her so unerringly. I'm not sure she knows herself, but you can see why I've trusted her judgment ever since. But still, it would have been so heart-stoppingly easy for us to miss one another. For me or Abby to show up an hour later for registration, for Justin to refuse our invitation, for Rafe to be just that little bit snippier so that we backed off and left him alone. Do you see now why I believe in miracles? I used to imagine time folding over, the shades of our future selves slipping back to the crucial moments to tap each of us on the shoulder and whisper, 'Look, there, look. That man, that woman, there for you. That's your life, your future.' Fidgeting in that line, tripping on the carpet, shuffling in that doorway. Don't miss it. How else could such a thing have happened?" He bent down and picked up our butts from the paving stones, one by one. "In all my life," he said simply, "these are the only four people I have ever loved." Then he stood up and walked off across the grass towards the house, with the bottle and the glass dangling from one hand and the cigarette butts cupped in the other. Chapter 20. The others came back still, heavy-eyed and headachy, and in a prickly mood. The film had been crap, they said. Some awful thing with a random Baldwin brother having endless supposedly comic misunderstandings with someone who looked like Terry Hatcher but wasn't. The cinema had been full of kids who were clearly below the age limit, and who had spent the whole 2 hours texting each other and eating crackly things and kicking the back of Justin's seat. Rafe and Justin were still very obviously not talking, and now Rafe and Abby apparently weren't either. Dinner was leftover lasagna, crunchy on top and scorched on the bottom, and eaten in tense silence. No one had bothered to make a salad to go with it, or to light the fire. "Just when I was about ready to scream," Daniel said calmly, glancing up. "By the way, Lexi, I meant to ask you something. I thought I might touch on Anne Finch with my Monday group, but I'm awfully rusty. Would you mind giving me a quick rundown after dinner?" Anne Finch wrote a poem from the point of view of a bird. She showed up here and there in Lexi's thesis notes, and that, since there are only 24 hours in a day, was basically all I knew about her. Rafe would have pulled something like this out of pure malicious mischief, yanking my chain just because he could. But Daniel never opened his mouth without a solid reason. That brief, strange alliance in the garden was over. He was showing me, starting with the little things, that if I insisted on sticking around, he could make my life very, very awkward. There was no way I was going to make an idiot of myself by spending my evening babbling about voice and identity to someone who knew I was talking rubbish. Lucky for me, Lexi had been an unpredictable brat, although probably luck had nothing to do with it. I was pretty sure she had constructed that side of her personality specifically for moments a lot like this one. "I don't feel like it," I said, keeping my head down and jabbing at my crunchy lasagna with my fork. There was an instant of silence. "Are you okay?" Justin asked. I shrugged, not looking up. "I guess." Something had just hit me. That silence and the fine thread of new tension through Justin's voice and quick glances flicking back and forth across the table, the others were instantly and so easily worried about me. Here I'd spent weeks trying to get them to relax, drop their guard. I had never thought about how fast I could send them skidding in the opposite direction, and how serious a weapon that might make if I used it right. I helped you with Ovid when you needed it, Daniel reminded me. Don't you remember? I spent ages finding you that quote. What was it? Obviously, I wasn't about to rise to that one. I'd only get mixed up and end up telling you about Mary Barber or someone. I can't think straight today. I shoved lasagna bits aimlessly around my plate. Never mind. Nobody was eaten anymore. You keep what? Abby asked. Leave it, Rafe said. God knows, I'm not in the mood for Anne Bloody Finch. If she's not either. Is something bothering you? Daniel asked me, politely. Leave her alone. Of course, Daniel said. Get some rest, Lexi. We'll do it another night when you're feeling better. I risked a quick look up. He had picked up his fork and knife again and was eating steadily, with nothing on his face but thoughtful absorption. This move had backfired. He was calmly, intently considering his next one. I went for a preemptive strike. After dinner we were all in the sitting room, reading, or anyway pretending to. No one had even suggested anything as social as a game of cards. The ashes from last night's fire were still in a dreary pile in the fireplace, and there was a soggy chill in the air. Distant bits of the house kept letting out sharp cracks or ominous groans, making us all jump. Rafe was kicking the hearth rail with the toe of one shoe in a steady, irritable rhythm, and I was fidgeting, changing position in my chair every few seconds. Between the two of us, we were making both Justin and Abby tenser every second. Daniel, head bent over something with an awful lot of footnotes, didn't seem to have noticed. Around 11, like always, I went out to the hall and put on my outdoor stuff. Then I went back to the sitting room and hung in the doorway, looking unsure. Going for a walk? Daniel asked. Yeah, I said. It might help me relax. Justin, will you come with me? Justin started, stared at me like a rabbit in headlights. Me? Why me? Why anyone? Daniel inquired with mild curiosity. I shrugged an uneasy twitch. I don't know, okay? My head feels weird, I keep thinking. I twisted my scarf around my finger, bit my lip. Maybe I had bad dreams last night. Nightmares, Rafe said, without looking up. Not bad dreams, you're not six. What kind of bad dreams? Abby asked. There was a tiny, worried furrow between her eyebrows. I shook my head. I don't remember, not properly, I just don't feel like being out in the lanes alone. But I don't either, said Justin. He looked really upset. I hate it out there, really hate it, not just, it's horrible, eerie. Can't someone else go? Or, Daniel suggested helpfully, if you're this anxious about going out, Lexi, why don't you stay at home? Because if I sit around in here any longer, I'm going to go crazy. I'll go with you, Abby said. Girl chat. No offense, Daniel said with a slight affectionate smile at Abby, but I think a homicidal maniac might be less intimidated by the two of you than he should be. If you're feeling nervous, Lexi, you should have someone large with you. Why don't you and I go? Rafe raised his head. If you're going, he told Daniel, then so am I. There was a small, tight silence. Rafe stared coldly at Daniel, unblinking. Daniel gazed calmly back. Why? He asked. Because he's a moron, Abby said, to her book. Ignore him and maybe he'll go away, or at least shut up. Wouldn't that be fun? I don't want you guys, I said. I was all ready for this, Daniel trying to join the party. I hadn't counted on Justin having some weird, unexplained phobia of country lanes, though. All you'll do is bitch at each other, and I'm not in the mood. I want Justin. I never see him anymore. Rafe snorted. You see him all day, every day. How much Justin can one person take? That's different. We haven't talked in ages, not properly. I can't go out there in the middle of the night, Lexi, Justin said. He looked like he was actually in pain. I would, honestly, but I just can't. Well, Daniel said to me, and Rafe, putting his book down. There was a glint in his eye, something like a wry, tired triumph. One all. Shall we go? Forget it, I said, giving them all a disgusted glare. Just forget it. Never mind. You can all stay here and bitch and complain. I'll go by myself, and if I get stabbed again, I hope you'll be happy. Just before I slammed the kitchen door, panes of glass trembling, I heard Rafe starting to say something and Abby's voice cutting across his, low and fierce, Shut up! When I turned back at the bottom of the garden, all four of them had their heads bent over their books again, in their pools of lamplight, glowing, enclosed, untouchable. The night had turned cloudy, the air thick and immovable as a wet duvet dumped over the hills. I walked fast, trying to wear myself out, aiming for the point where I could fool myself that it was the exercise making my heart race. I thought of that great imaginary clock I'd felt somewhere in the background, my first couple of days, urging me faster. Sometime after that, it had faded away into nothing, left me swaying to Whitethorn House's own sweet, slow rhythms, with all the time in the world. Now it was back, ticking savagely and getting louder every minute, speeding towards some huge, shadowy 0 hour. I rang Frank from down in one of the lanes. Even the thought of climbing my tree, having to stay in one place, made me itch all over. There you are, he said. What were you doing? Running a marathon? I leaned against a tree trunk and tried to get my breathing back to normal. Trying to walk off my hangover, clear my head. Always a good idea, Frank agreed. First off, babe, well done last night. I'll buy you a fancy cocktail for that one when you get home. I think you may just have got us the break we needed. Maybe. I'm not counting chickens. For all we know, Ned could be bullshitting me about the whole thing. He tries to buy Lexi's share of the house, she blows him off. He decides to give it one more go. Then I mention the memory loss and he sees his chance to convince me we had a deal all along. He's no Einstein, but he's no idiot either. Not when it comes to wheeling and dealing. Maybe not, Frank said. Maybe not. How'd you manage to hook up with him anyway? I had my answer to that one already. I've been keeping an eye on that cottage every night. I figured Lexi went there for a reason. And if she was meeting someone, that would be the logical place. So I thought there was a decent chance whoever it was would show up there again. And slow Eddie wanders in, Frank said blandly. Just when I told you about the house, giving the two of you something to talk about. He's got good timing. Why didn't you ring me after he left? My head was buzzing, Frankie. All I could think about was how this changes the case, how I can use it, what I do next, how to find out if Ned's bullshitting. I meant to phone you, but it went straight out of my head. Better late than never. So, how was your day? His voice was pleasant, absolutely neutral, giving away nothing. I know, I'm a lazy cow, I said, giving it an apologetic cringe. I should have tried to get something out of Daniel while I had him to myself, but I just couldn't face it. My head was killing me, and you know what Daniel's like. He's not exactly light entertainment, sorry. Said Frank, not very reassuringly. And what's with the strappy bitch act? I'm assuming it was an act. I want to unsettle them, I said, which was true. We've tried relaxing them into talking, and it hasn't worked. What with the new info, I think it's time to kick it up a gear. It didn't occur to you to talk that over with me before you swung into action. I left a small, startled pause. I just figured you'd guess what I was at. Okay, Frank said in a mild voice that started sirens rising in my head. You've done a great job, Cass. I know you didn't want to get involved, and I appreciate the fact that you did it anyway. You're a good cop. It felt like something had hit me in the stomach. What, Frank? I said. What I already knew. He laughed. Relax, it's good news. Time to wind it up, babe.
I want you to go home and start complaining that you feel like you're getting the flu. Dizzy, feverish, achy. Don't mention the wound hurting or they'll want to look at it. Just feel crap all over. Maybe wake one of them up during the night. Justin's the worrier, isn't he? And tell him it's getting worse. If they haven't taken you to the emergency room by morning, make them. I'll handle it from there.
My nails were cutting into my hand.
Why? I thought you'd be delighted, Frank said, doing taken aback and a little miffed. You didn't want.
I didn't want to go in to start with. I know. But I'm in now, and I'm getting close.
Why the hell would you want to pull the plug? Because I didn't ask you before I rattled these guys' cage?
God, no, said Frank, still all bland surprise.
Nothing to do with that. You went in to find a direction for this investigation, and you've done that beautifully. Congratulations, babe. Your work here is done.
No, I said, it's not. You sent me in to find a suspect. Those were your exact words, and so far all I've found is a possible motive with four possible suspects attached. Five, if you take into account that Ned could be lying his little head off. How does that move the investigation forwards exactly? The four of them will stick to their story just like you said at the beginning, and you're right back where you started. Let me do my fucking job.
I'm looking out for you, that's my job. With what you've found out, you could be at risk here and I can't just ignore. Bullshit, Frank. If one of those four killed her, I've been in danger since day one, and it never bothered you one bit till now. Keep your voice down. Is that it? You're pissed off because I haven't been protective enough.
I could practically see his hands flying up in outrage, the wide, offended blue eyes.
Give me a break, Frank. I'm a big girl. I can take care of myself. And you've never had a problem with that idea before, so why the fuck are you pulling me out?
There was a silence. Finally, Frank sighed.
Fine, he said. You want to know why?
Fine.
I no longer feel that you're maintaining the objectivity required to serve this investigation.
What are you talking about? My heart was hammering. If he had surveillance on the house after all, or if he'd guessed that I'd taken off the mic, I should never have left it for so long, I thought wildly.
Stupid. I should have gone back inside every few minutes and made some kind of noise. You're way too emotionally involved. I'm not stupid, Cassie. I have a fair idea what happened last night, and I know there's shit you're not telling me. Those are warning signs, and I'm not going to ignore them.
He had fallen for the foray. He didn't know I'd been burned. My heart rate went down a notch.
You're losing your boundaries. Maybe I should never have pressured you to do this. I don't know the ins and outs of what happened to you on Mordor, and I'm not asking. But it clearly wrecked your head, and you obviously weren't ready for something like this just yet.
I have a flashbang temper, and if I lost it now, the argument was over. I would have proved Frank's point. That was probably exactly what he was angling for. I kicked the tree trunk instead, hard enough that for a second I thought I'd broken my toe. When I could talk, I said coolly, "My head is doing just fine, Frank, and so are my boundaries. Every one of my actions has been directed towards achieving the goal of this investigation and finding a prime suspect in the murder of Lexi Madison, and I'd like to finish the job."
"Sorry, Cassie," Frank said, gently but very firmly. "Not this time."
There's one thing about undercover that no one mentions, ever. The rule is, the handler holds the brake. He's the one who decides when you need to pull back or come out. He's the one with the overview after all. He may well have info that you don't, and you do what he says if you value either your life or your career. But here's the part we never talk about. The grenade you carry with you always. He can't make you. I had never known anyone to throw that grenade before, but every one of us knows it's there. If you were to say no, there would be, for a little while at least, and that might be all you needed. Fuck all your handler could do about it. That kind of breach of trust can't be repaired. In that second, I saw the airport codes in Lexi's datebook, that hard, ruthless scrawl. "I'm staying," I said. A sharp wave of wind ran through the woods and I felt my tree shiver, a deep judder going up into my bones.
No, Frank said, you're not. Don't give me hassle on this, Cassie. The decision's been made. There's no point in us fighting about it. Go home, pack your stuff, and start playing sick. I'll see you tomorrow.
You put me in here to do a job, I said. I'm not leaving till I get it done. I'm not fighting about it, Frank. I'm just telling you. This time, Frank understood. His voice didn't sharpen, but it had an undertow that made my shoulders go up. Do you want me to pick you up off the street, find drugs on you, and throw you in jail till you pull yourself together? Because I'll do it. No, you won't. The others know Lexi doesn't do drugs, and if she gets dragged in on a bogus charge and then dies while in police custody, they'll kick up such a stink that this whole operation will go up in flames, and you'll be cleaning up the mess for years. There was a silence while Frank evaluated the situation. You know this could end your career, don't you? He said eventually. You're disobeying a direct order from a superior officer. You know I could haul you in, take your badge and your gun, and fire you on the spot. Yeah, I said. I know. But he wouldn't do it. Not Frank. And I knew I was taking advantage of that. I knew something else, too. I'm not sure how. Maybe from the lack of shock in his voice. Sometime in his career, he had done the same thing himself. And you know you're making me miss my weekend with Holly. It's her birthday tomorrow. You want to explain to her why Daddy can't be there after all? I winced, but I reminded myself that this was Frank. Holly's birthday was probably months away. So go, let someone else monitor the mic feed. Not a chance. Even if I wanted to, I don't have anyone else. The budget's run out in this one. The brass are sick of paying officers to sit around listening to you drink wine and strip wallpaper. I don't blame them, I said. What you do with the mic feed is your call. Leave it to monitor itself if you want. That's your half of the gig. I'm just doing mine.
Okay, Frank said on a long, suffering sigh. Okay. Here's what we're going to do. You've got 48 hours, starting now, to wind this up.
72
on three conditions. You don't do anything stupid, you keep calling in, and you keep that mic on you at all times. I want your word.
Something prickled inside me. Maybe he did know, after all. With Frank, you can never be sure.
Got it, I said. I promise. 3 days from now, even if you're an inch away from breaking the case, you come in. Bye.
Watch check.
12:45 on Monday, you're out of that house and in an emergency room, or at least on your way there. Until then, I'm going to hang on to this tape. If you stick to those conditions and you come in on time, I'll erase it, and no one else ever needs to know about this conversation. If you give me one more iota of hassle, I will haul your arse in, whatever that takes and whatever consequences it has, and I will fire you. We clear?
Yeah, I said. We're crystal clear. I'm not trying to fuck you around, Frank. It's not about that.
This, Cassie, Frank said, was a really, really bad idea. I hope you know that.
There was a beep, and then nothing. Just waves of static in my ear. My hands were shaking so hard that I dropped the phone twice before I managed to hit end. The irony of it, he was millimeters from right. Even 24 hours earlier, I hadn't been working this case. I'd been letting it work me, free-falling into it, full fathom five and swimming deeper. There were 1,000 tiny phrases and glances and objects that had been scattered through this case like breadcrumbs, going overlooked and unconnected because I had wanted, or thought I wanted, to be Lexi Madison so much more than I wanted to solve her murder. What Frank didn't know, and what I couldn't tell him, was that Ned, of all people, without ever having a clue he was doing it, had pulled me back, I wanted to close this case, and I was ready. And this isn't something I say lightly. To do whatever it took. Probably, you could say I came back fighting because I had been suckered, almost fatally. And this was my last chance to make up for that. Or because the only way I would ever get my career back, it's my job, I had said to Daniel, before I knew the words were going to come out, was if I got a salve here. Or because our lost Operation Vestal had poisoned the air around me and I needed an antidote. Maybe a little of all three. Because this was the one I couldn't get away from. No matter what this woman had been or done, we had been built into each other since we were born. We had led each other to this life, this place. I knew things about her that no one else knew in all the world. I couldn't leave her now. There was no one else to look through her eyes and read her mind, trace the silvery lines of runes she had left trailing behind her, tell the only story she had ever finished. All I knew was that I needed the end of that story, that I needed to be the one who brought it home, and that I was frightened. I don't scare easy, but just like Daniel, I've always known that there's a price to pay. What Daniel didn't know or didn't mention is what I said right at the beginning. The price is a wildfire, shape-changing thing, and you're not always the one who chooses. You're not always allowed to know in advance what it's going to be. The other thing, hitting me over and over with a horrible sick lurch every time. This could have been why she had come looking for me. This could have been what she had wanted all along. Someone to change places with her. Someone longing for the chance to toss away her own battered life, let it evaporate like morning mist over grass. Someone who would gladly fade to a scent of bluebells and a green shoot, while this girl strengthened and bloomed and turned solid again and lived. I think it was only in that moment I believed she was dead. This girl I had never seen alive. I'll never be free of her. I wear her face. As I get older, it'll stay her changing mirror, the one glimpse of all the ages she never had. I lived her life for a few strange, bright weeks. Her blood went into making me what I am, the same way it went to make the bluebells and the hawthorn tree. But when I had the chance to take that final step over the border, lie down with Daniel among the ivy leaves and the sound of water, let go of my own life with all its scars and all its wreckage, and start new, I turned it down. The air was so still. Any minute now, I would have to go back to Whitethorn House and do my best to wreck it. Out of nowhere, I wanted to talk to Sam so badly, it was like being hit in the stomach. It felt like the most urgent thing in the world, to tell him, before it was too late, that I was coming home. That in the ways that mattered most, I was already back. That I was scared, terrified as a kid in the dark, and that I needed to hear his voice. His phone was off. All I got was the voicemail woman telling me archly to leave a message. Sam was working, taking his turn surveying Naylor's house, going through statement sheets for the dozenth time in case he had missed something. If I'd been the crying type, I would have cried then. Before I understood that I was doing it, I set my phone number to private and dialed Rob's mobile. I pressed my free hand flat over the mic and felt my heart going slow and hard under my palm. I knew this was very possibly the stupidest thing I'd done in my life, but I didn't know how not to do it. Ryan, he said on the second ring, wide awake. Rob always had trouble sleeping. When I couldn't answer, he said with a sudden new alertness in his voice, "Hello?" I hung up. In the second before my thumb hit the button, I thought I heard him say fast and urgent, "Cassie?" But my hand was already moving, and it was too late for me to pull it back even if I had wanted to. I slid down the side of the tree and sat there, with my arms wrapped tight around myself for a long time. There was this night, during our last case. At 3 in the morning I got on my Vespa and went down to the crime scene to pick Rob up. On the way back, the roads were all ours that late, and I was going fast. Rob leaned into the turns with me and the bike barely seemed to feel the extra weight. Two high beams came at us around a bend, brilliant and growing till they filled the whole road, a lorry, half over the center line and coming straight for us. But the bike swayed out of the way, light as a stalk of grass, and the lorry was passed in a great whack of wind and dazzle. Rob's hands on my waist shook every now and then, a quick, violent tremor, and I was thinking of home and warmth and whether I had anything in the fridge. Neither of us knew it, but we were speeding through the last few hours we had. I leaned on that friendship, loose and unthinking, as if it were a wall 6 foot thick. But less than a day later it started to crumble and avalanche, and there was nothing in the world I could do to hold it together. In the nights afterwards, I used to wake up with my mind full of those headlights, brighter and deeper than the sun. I saw them again behind my eyelids in that dark lane, and I understood then that I could have just kept driving. I could have been like Lexi. I could have hit full speed and taken us soaring up off the road, into the vast silence at the heart of those lights, and out on the other side where nothing could touch us, ever. Chapter 21. It only took Daniel a couple of hours to come up with his next move. I was sitting up in bed, staring at the brothers grim and reading the same sentence over and over without taking in a word of it, when there was a quick, discreet rap on my door. "Come in," I called. Daniel put his head in the door. He was still dressed, spotless in his white shirt and shining shoes.
"Do you have a minute?"
he inquired politely. "Of course," I said, just as politely, putting down the book. There was no way this was a surrender, or even a truce. But I couldn't think of anything either of us could try, not without the others there for weapons.
"I just wanted," Daniel said, turning to close the door behind him, "a quick word with you, in private."
My body thought faster than my mind. In that second when his back was to me, before I knew why I was doing it, I grabbed the mic wire through my pajama top, gave it a hard upwards yank, and felt the pop as the jack came free. By the time he looked around again, my hands were lying innocently on the book.
"About what?" I asked. "There are a few things," Daniel said, smoothing the bottom of the duvet and sitting down, "that have been bothering me."
"Oh?"
"Yes. Almost since you, well, let's say arrived. Small inconsistencies, growing more troubling as time went on. By the time you asked for more onions the other evening, I had serious questions."
He left a polite pause in case I wanted to contribute anything to the conversation. I stared at him. I couldn't believe I hadn't seen this one coming.
"And then, of course," he said when it was obvious that I wasn't going to answer, "we come to last night. As you may or may not know, on a few occasions you and I, or at any rate, Lexi and I, have, well, suffice it to say that a kiss can be as individual and unmistakable as a laugh. When we kissed last night, it left me more or less positive that you're not Lexi."
He gazed at me blandly across the bed. He was burning me, all over again, every way he knew how, with my boss, with the boyfriend he had guessed at, with the brass who would not approve of an undercover smooching a suspect. They were his brand new remote-controlled weapons. If that mic had been plugged in, I would have been a few hours away from a grim trip home and a one-way ticket to a desk in Offaly.
"Absurd though this may sound," Daniel said tranquilly, "I'd like to see the supposed stab wound, simply to reassure myself that you're actually who you're claiming to be."
"Sure," I said cheerfully. "Why not?" And saw the startled flicker in his eyes. I pulled up my pajama top and tugged the bandage free to show him the jack and the battery pack, separate. "Nice shot," I told him, "but no dice. And if you do get me pulled out, do you think I'll go quietly? I'll have nothing to lose. Even if all I've got is 5 minutes, I'll use them to tell the others who I am
and that you've known for weeks. How well do you think that'll go down with, say, Rafe?
Daniel leaned forwards to inspect the mic.
Ah, he said.
Well, it was worth a try.
My time's almost up in this case anyway, I said. I was talking fast. Frank would have started getting suspicious the instant the mic feed died. I had maybe a minute before his head went up in smoke. I've only got a few days left, but I want those few days. If you try to take them away from me, I'll go down all guns blazing. If you don't, you still have a good chance that I won't get anything worthwhile, and we can work it out so the others never have to know who I was. He watched me, expressionless, those big square hands tidily clasped in his lap.
My friends are my responsibility. I'm not going to stand back and let you sweep them off into corners for interrogation.
I shrugged. Fair enough. Try and stop me any way you can. You didn't have any trouble tonight. Just don't mess with my last few days. Deal?
How many days? Daniel asked.
Exactly. I shook my head. Not in the deal. In about 10 seconds, I'm going to plug this in again, so it sounds like an accidental disconnect, and we're going to have a harmless little chat about why I was in a mood at dinner, okay?
He nodded absently, still examining the mic.
Great, I said. Here goes. I don't feel like, I plugged the wire back in halfway through the sentence for an extra touch of realism, talking about it. My head's a mess. Everything feels sucky. I just want everyone to leave me alone, okay?
You're probably just hungover, Daniel said obligingly. You've always had a hard time with red wine, haven't you?
Everything sounded like a trap. Whatever, I said, giving him an irritable teenager shrug and sticking my bandage back down. Maybe it was the punch. Rafe probably put meths in it. He's drinking a lot more these days, have you noticed?
Rafe is fine, Daniel said coolly. And so will you be, I hope. After a good night's sleep.
Quick footsteps downstairs and a door opening. Lexi! Justin called anxiously up the stairs. Is everything okay? Daniel's annoying me! I shouted back. Daniel! How are you annoying her?
I'm not.
He wants to know why I feel crap, I called. I feel crap because I just do, and I want him to leave me alone.
You feel crap because what?
Justin had come out of his room to the bottom of the stairs. I could picture him, in his striped pajamas, clutching the banister and peering short-sightedly upwards. Daniel was giving me an intent, thoughtful gaze that made me edgy as hell.
Shut up!
Yelled Abby, furious enough that we could hear her right through her door.
Some of us are trying to sleep here.
Lexi, you feel crap because what? A thud. Abby had thrown something.
Justin, I said shut up, Jesus!
Faintly from the ground floor, Rafe shouted something irritable that sounded like, what the hell is going on?
I'll come down and explain, Justin, Daniel called. Everyone go back to bed.
To me.
Good night.
He stood up and smoothed the duvet again.
Sleep well. I hope you'll feel better in the morning.
Yeah, I said.
Thanks. Don't count on it.
The steady rhythm of his footsteps going downstairs, then hushed voices below me. At first, a lot of Justin and an occasional brief interjection from Daniel, shifting gradually till it was the other way round. I got out of bed, carefully, and put my ear to the floor, but they were talking barely above whispers and I couldn't make out the words. It was 20 minutes before Daniel came back upstairs, softly, pausing for a long few seconds on the landing. I didn't start shaking until his bedroom door closed behind him. I stayed awake for hours that night, flipping pages and pretending to read, rustling the covers and doing deep breaths and pretending to be asleep, unplugging the mic for a few seconds or a few minutes every now and then. I think I created a pretty good impression of a jack coming loose, disconnecting and reconnecting itself as I moved. But it didn't reassure me. Frank is very far from stupid, and he was in no humor to give me the benefit of any doubts. Frank to the left of me, Daniel to the right, and here I was, stuck in the middle with Lexi. I passed the time while I played my Mike Jack game, by trying to work out how it was logistically possible for me to have ended up on the opposite side from absolutely everyone else involved in this case, including people who were on opposite sides from each other. Before I finally went to sleep, I took the chair from Lexi's dressing table for the first time in weeks and braced it against my door. Saturday went fast in a helpless nightmare daze. Daniel had decided, partly because working on the house always settled them all down, presumably, and partly to keep everyone in one room and under his eye, that we needed to spend the day sanding floors. "We've been neglecting the dining room," he told us at breakfast. "It's starting to look terribly shabby, next to the sitting room. I think today we should start bringing it up to scratch. What do you think?"
"Good idea," said Abby, sliding eggs onto his plate and giving him a tired, determinedly positive smile.
Justin shrugged and went back to picking at toast. I said, "Whatever," into the frying pan. Rafe took his coffee and left without a word.
"Good," Daniel said serenely, going back to his book. "That's a plan, then."
The rest of the day was just about as excruciating as I'd expected. The happy place magic was apparently on its day off. Rafe was in a silent, fuming rage for the whole world. He kept banging the sander into the walls, making everyone jump, till Daniel took it out of his hands without a word and passed him a sheet of sandpaper instead. I turned up my sulk as loud as I could and hoped it would have some effect on someone, and that sooner or later, not too much later, I would find a way to use it. Outside the windows it was raining, thin, petulant rain. We didn't talk. Once or twice I saw Abby wipe her face, but she always had her back to the rest of us, and I couldn't tell if she was crying or if it was just the sawdust. It got everywhere, drifting up our noses, down our necks, working its way into the skin of our hands. Justin wheezed ostentatiously and had great dramatic coughing fits into a handkerchief, until finally Daniel put down the sander, stalked out, and came back with an ancient, hideous gas mask, which he held out to Justin in silence. No one laughed.
"They've got asbestos in them," Rafe said, scrubbing viciously at an awkward corner of floor. "Are you actually trying to kill him, or do you just want to give that impression?"
Justin gave the mask a horrified look.
"I don't want to breathe asbestos."
"If you'd prefer to tie your handkerchief around your mouth," said Daniel, "then do that instead. Just stop moaning."
He shoved the mask into Justin's hands, went back to the sander and fired it up again. The gas mask that had sent me and Rafe into a giddy fit that night on the patio. Daniel can wear it into college. We'll get Abby to embroider it. Justin dumped it gingerly in a bare corner, where it sat for the rest of the day, staring at us all with huge, empty, desolate eyes.
"What's been going on with your mic?" Frank inquired that night. "Just out of curiosity."
"Ah, fuck," I said.
"What, it's doing it again? I thought I'd fixed it."
A skeptical pause.
"Doing what again?"
"This morning when I went to change my bandage, the jack was out. I think I put the bandage on wrong after my shower last night and the jack pulled out when I moved. How much did you miss? Is it working now?"
I stuck a hand down my top and tapped the mic. "Can you hear that?" "Loud and clear," Frank said dryly. "It popped out a few times during the night, but I doubt I missed anything significant there. I certainly hope not, anyway. I lost a minute or two of your midnight chat with Daniel, though."
I put a grin in my voice.
"Oh, that? He was edgy because of the strappy bitch act. He wanted to know what was wrong, so I told him to leave me alone. Then the others heard us and got in on the action, and he gave up and went to bed. I told you it would work, Frankie. They're going up the walls."
"Right," Frank said after a moment. "So apparently I didn't miss anything educational. And as long as I'm working this case, I suppose I can't say I don't believe in coincidences. But if that wire happens to come loose again,
even for one second. I'm coming down there and dragging you in by the scruff of your neck, so get out your super glue. And he hung up. I walked home trying to work out what I would do next if I were in Daniel's shoes. But as it turned out, he wasn't the one I should have been worrying about. I knew, even before I got into the house, that something had happened. They were all in the kitchen. The guys had obviously been halfway through the washing up. Rafe was holding a spatula like a weapon, and Justin was dripping suds all over the floor, and they were all talking at once.
Doing their job, Daniel was saying flatly as I opened the French doors. If we don't let them...
But why?
Justin wailed over him.
Why would they?
Then they saw me. There was a second of absolute silence, all of them staring at me, voices sliced off in mid-word.
What's going on?
I asked.
The cops want us to come in, said Rafe.
He threw the spatula into the sink with a clang and a splash. Water spattered on Daniel's shirt, but he didn't seem to notice.
I can't go through that again,
Justin said, sagging back against the counter.
I can't.
Come in where? What for?
Mackie rang Daniel, said Abby. They want us to come talk to them. First thing tomorrow morning. All of us.
Why?
That tow rag, Frank. He had known when I phoned him that he was going to pull this crap. He hadn't even bothered to hint at it. Rafe shrugged.
He didn't share, just that he, quote, wants a chat with us, unquote.
But why there?
Justin demanded frantically. He was staring at Daniel's phone on the kitchen table like it might pounce.
Before they always came here, why do we have to...
Where does he want us to go? I asked. Dublin Castle, Abby said. The Serious Crime Officer Squad, or whatever they call it. Serious and organized crime work downstairs for murder. All Frank had to do was whisk us up an extra flight of stairs. S&O do not investigate your average stabbing, not unless there's a crime lord involved, but the others didn't know that, and it sounded impressive.
Did you know about this?
Daniel asked me. He was giving me a cold stare that I didn't like one bit. Rafe raised his eyes to the ceiling and muttered something that included the words paranoid freak.
No. How would I?
I thought your friend Mackie might have rung you as well while you were out.
He didn't, and he's not my friend. I didn't bother hiding the pissed-off look. Let Daniel try to figure out whether it was genuine. I had 2 days left, and Frank was going to eat away one of them with endless, pointless, nothing questions about what we put in our sandwiches and how we felt about four boobs Brenda. He wanted us first thing in the morning. He was planning to stretch this out for as long as he could. 8 hours? 12? I wondered if it would be in character for Lexi to kick him in the ghoulies.
I knew we shouldn't have rung them about that rock,
Justin said wretchedly.
I knew it. They were leaving us alone.
So let's not go, I said. Probably Frank would class this as doing something stupid, breaking one of his conditions, but I was too annoyed to care.
They can't make us.
A startled pause.
Is that true?
Abby asked Daniel.
I think so, actually.
Daniel said. He was examining me speculatively. I could almost hear the wheels spinning.
We're not under arrest. This was a request, not a command, although that's not how Mackie made it sound. All the same, I think we need to go.
Oh, do you?
Rafe inquired, not nicely.
Do you really? And what if I think we should let Mackie go fuck himself?
Daniel turned to look at him.
I plan to continue cooperating fully with the investigation, he said calmly. Partly because I think it's wise, but mainly because I'd like to know who did this terrible thing. If any of you would prefer to stand in the way and raise Mackie's suspicions by refusing to cooperate, I can't stop you. But remember, the person who stabbed Lexi is still out there, and I for one think we should do our best to help catch him.
The smart... arsed bastard. He was using my mic to feed Frank exactly what he wanted him to hear. which apparently was a heap of pious clichés. The two of them were perfect for each other. Daniel glanced inquiringly around the kitchen. No one answered. Rafe started to say something, checked himself, and shook his head in disgust.
Good, said Daniel. In that case, let's finish up here and get to bed. Tomorrow's going to be a long day.
And he picked up the dishcloth. I was in the sitting room with Abby, pretending to read and thinking up creative new words for Frank and listening to the tense silence coming from the kitchen, when I realized something. Given the choice, Daniel had decided he'd prefer to spend one of my last few days with Frank, rather than with me. I figured, in its own dangerous way, that was probably a compliment. What I remember most about Sunday morning is that we did the whole breakfast routine, every step of it. Abby's quick tap on my door, the two of us making breakfast side by side, her face flushed from the heat of the stove. We moved easily around each other, passing things back and forth without having to ask. I remembered that first evening, the pang as I'd seen how closely woven together they were. Somehow, along the way, I had become part of that. Justin frowning at his toast as he sliced it into triangles. Rafe's autopilot maneuver with the coffee. Daniel with the edge of a book caught under the corner of his plate. I didn't let myself think, even for a splinter of a second, about the fact that in 36 hours, I would be gone. The fact that, even if I were to see them again someday, it would never be like this. We took our time. Even Rafe resurfaced once he had finished his coffee, nudging me sideways with his hip so he could share my chair and nick bites off my toast. Dew ran down the window panes, and the rabbits, they were getting cheekier and closer every day, were nibbling the grass outside. Something had changed during the night. The jagged cutting edges between the four of them had melted away. They were gentle with one another, careful, almost tender. Sometimes I wonder if they took such care with that breakfast because at some level, deeper and surer than logic, they knew.
We should go, Daniel said, finally.
He closed his book, reached to put it on the counter. I felt a breath, something between a catch and a sigh, ripple around the table. Rafe's chest rose quickly against my shoulder.
Right, Abby said softly, almost to herself. Let's do this.
There's something I'd like to discuss with you, Lexi, Daniel said. Why don't you and I ride into town together?
Discuss what?
Rafe asked sharply. His fingers dug into my arm.
If it were any of your business, Daniel said, taking his plate to the sink, I would have invited you to join us.
The jagged edges crystallized again, out of nowhere, fine and slicing the air.
So, Daniel said, when he had pulled up his car in front of the house and I got in beside him. Here we are.
Something smoky curled through me. A warning. It was the way he was looking not at me, but out the car window. At the house in cool morning mist. At Justin rubbing his windscreen fussily with a folded rag, and Rafe slumping down the stairs with his chin tucked deep into his scarf. It was the expression on his face, intent and thoughtful, and just a touch sad. I had no way of knowing what this guy's limits were, or if he had any. My gun was behind Lexi's bedside table. Murder has a metal detector.
The only time you'll be out of coverage, Frank had said, is on the drive to and from town.
Daniel smiled, a small private smile up at the hazy blue sky.
It's going to be a beautiful day, he said.
I was about to slam out the car, stamp over to Justin and tell him Daniel was being horrible and demand to ride with him and the others. It seemed to be the week for complicated vicious spats. Nobody would be suspicious of one more. When the door behind me flew open and Abby slid into the back seat, flushed and tangle-haired, in a tumble of gloves and hat and coat. "Hey," she said, slamming the door. "Can I come with you guys?"
"Sure," I said.
I'd seldom been that glad to see